have seen another world, an honest world, a world decidedly more fair than the one in which we now live.
We saw that in this world, there was no need for armies. Peace, justice, and liberty were common like bread, air, and water.
And in this world, there was reason and goodwill in the government. And the leaders were clear-thinking people. They ruled by obeying.
This world was not a dream. It was not something that came from ancestors. It came from ahead, from the next step, where we're going, what we're going to take.
And so we started to move forward to attain this dream, make it come and sit down at our tables, light our homes, grow in our cornfields, fill the hearts of our children, wipe our sweat, heal our history, and it was for all.
This is what we want, nothing more, nothing less.
From Subcomandante Marcos from the mountains of the Mexican Southeast. You are about to watch a collection of images, voices, music, and marching from South Korea to Mexico, Palestine to New York, Quebec, Genoa, Iraq, and South Africa. Our friends at Big Noise Tactical, our scribes, our journalists, will tell you that this film does not belong to them. It is made up of the people and their movements, and it presents us with the thousands of collective acts of disobedience and rebellion that are the Fourth World War, a war for survival and dignity in the face of corporate globalization.
Now we're like, what's going on next? Exactly. Now we everybody's here.
I'm sorry. All right. The following speaker is the author of the critically acclaimed Fat Cats and Running Dogs. Please welcome Vijay Prashad.
First thing I should do is to thank Bilal El Amin for inviting me. I've never met Bilal but in person, I've communicated with him quite a bit. Bilal is the muezzin of our movement, Bilal El Amin. Okay, thank you for having me. I don't know why he invited me. I feel so completely overawed by the people on the stage that I'm sitting with. So please forgive me for all the scattered thoughts and things I want to say to you. Basically, I have one message, and that is that every country gets the fascism that it deserves. And that's the message I'm going to promote today. Every country gets the fascism it deserves. You know, it's interesting that we live in this kind of bubble where we believe that fascism happened in Italy and Germany, and every fascism must resemble it. And you know, we in fact live with that kind of fear-mongering from liberals and others who have us believe that the real fascists are neo-Nazis and other fringe idiots who live in our society and who are generally, basically delegitimized. That they are the fascists and everybody else is within reasonable discourse. You understand? That if you don't have a swastika, if you don't shave your head, if you don't hate Jews, then you cannot be a fascist. You understand? They are the real fascists. Everybody else is somehow liberal and reasonable. They have made the space and category of fascism restricted only to the lunatics, and they can then sit back and say that they are progressives. They are making democracy happen around the world. They are exporting democracy, in fact, to places like Iraq and Afghanistan, etc. They are reasonable. We have, as a great sociologist and writer wrote 25, maybe 30 years ago, I don't remember, he wrote the book Friendly Fascism. We have a friendly fascism in the United States, friendly for some, fascist for others. Basically, you know who it's friendly toward and who it's fascist against. It is fascist every day against people who live in oppressed communities, who live in generalized poverty. And certainly, since the United States isn't a territory, but since the United States is the world, it is fascist toward the bulk of the population of the world. So think about it. When we think about fascism, no longer, I would submit to you, should we think of fascism only within the bounds of a nation state. We have to think about something that you might consider as global fascism. This is a friendly fascism globally, friendly to the global elites, who also sup, you know, at the high table, and fascist toward everybody else who wants to make their dreams and destiny. It is that kind of friendly fascism, and that has to be confronted. The face of that fascism doesn't matter if he's an idiot, if he has a low IQ, all that stuff is irrelevant. It is that stuff that's making the ruling class in the United States split in its consensus. They would like to replace this moron with another intelligent fascist, and that is their game. They are embarrassed by imbecilism, but not by fascism. This doesn't mean I won't vote for Kerry, by the way. Let me put it to you this way, my friends. This kind of friendly fascism that went to war in Iraq, you know, we think and we are told constantly that this is, of course, the greatest country in the world. You know that that is one of the illusions of fascism. We are the greatest country. We are the Fourth Reich, the Fifth Reich, maybe the Sixth Reich. Who's counting any longer? One of the Reichs, certainly, which will have its thousand-year Reich finally. But we are also told we are a booming economy. But don't be fooled by that, my friends. Of course, within, this is in complete crisis. I'm not one of those lefties, by the way, that's always foretelling crisis. But when you have $7 trillion debt, when that debt is held overseas by other corrupt elites who basically have the United States economy on a stranglehold, and they also are committed to the protection of the dollar, you understand, as the main currency in the world. And when another savage like Saddam Hussein, you understand, he is our savage first, and then he becomes their savage. In other words, he is our savage to beat the Iranians. When that becomes beside the point, suddenly he becomes the savage and must be overthrown. But when Saddam Hussein comes to the OPEC nations a year ago and says, listen, no, 2 years ago now, let's change our holdings from our petrodollars to petro-euros. You know, that kind of thing sends a real chill into the hearts of financial markets globally. Because nobody wants the dollar to lose its standing. All that money held in Switzerland, for instance, by corrupt elites around the world, is not held in Swiss francs. That's held in dollars. All the profits that were by Mobutu, you know, the $10 million that Mobutu had in the Swiss bank, which was equivalent to the Congo's debt, identical with the debt of his own country, that $10 million was held in dollars. All these elites around the world need to keep the dollar stable. When Saddam Hussein, you know, of course, you know, I mean, what can one say about Saddam Hussein? When Saddam Hussein, you know, lunatic that he was, see how we have to talk about human beings, you know. We have to justify ourselves. We have to say, Najaf, they are crazy. Najaf is on fire today. You can't be in America and say that maybe the people of Najaf want to stand up for their own rights. By the way, in the New York Times, Jeffrey Gettleman, and we have what? 25 minutes each? Half an hour? 2 hours? Somebody has to be Al Sharpton, you know. I know, I'm sorry. Jeffrey Gettleman in the New York Times wrote a brilliant line. He met a Marine, and the Marine said, my friend, if they came to San Diego, that is, some foreigners came to San Diego, we would fight up and stand against them just like the people of Najaf. Of course, he doesn't know what he's talking about because, my friends, we are already under occupation and we have no idea what to do. You know, we are the most disorganized population. We have sporadic resistance. But we don't know really how to stand up against tyranny and fascism. So let me now start with my sense of what does it mean in our movements, our thriving social movements, our alive social movements. What has it meant for us to fight power? I'll submit to you that in the last century, we have made enormous gains. Please do not talk of our social movements without acknowledging the massive gains we have made. We have made enormous gains. But power is very intelligent. Power is not static. Power is not dumb. Just when we won the right to vote, for instance, in the state, just when people won equal rights in the state, they disemboweled the state. You understand? Just when we got the chance to become part of the state structure, just when... You're cutting me off already? I thought we have 10 minutes.
We want to hear you better. You're on a roll, man. Keep going.
All right.
They want to hear you better. Isn't he great?
Do they need to hear me better?
Yeah, they do. All right, so just stay around here.
Okay, sorry. That means I get about 5 minutes extra. Just when we won our rights in the state. Is that better? Please don't speak disparagingly about our major social movements. Just when we want rights in the state, power very cleverly and craftily disemboweled the state. If you talk to people, and you may just talk to yourselves because you've all had this experience, when you do any community organizing and you finally enter town hall, like for instance people did in South Africa, in the United States, you enter town hall, you've brought 300-400 people to fight against, say, you know, wanting to increase or keep the power alive in the winter, to keep heating alive, etc. Nobody in town hall says we can make any decisions. In fact, some of the people say we are on your side, but there's nothing we can do. In fact, they are giving us the classic line of the International Monetary Fund and Margaret Thatcher, which is there is no alternative, what they call TINA. There is nothing we can do. And in fact, their hands are tied. But we are also therefore working in wheels that are spinning and having very little traction. You have to understand that people have organized greatly, but our gains in the last 15 years have been minimal. And I want us to think about why our gains have been minimal. I'd like to suggest to you that around the country, community organizations are having a very serious discussion about just this. I'll just share with you in a few minutes two examples. One at the Center for Third World Organizing in Oakland, and the other in Alexandria, Virginia, at the Tenants and Workers Support Committee. There have been extensive discussions about what they are calling municipal socialism. For instance, by the way, the phrase that we should think about is not TINA anymore. If you went to the World Social Forum in Mumbai, or if you heard reports from there, the new slogan is not TINA, it is SITA. Socialism is the alternative. Anyway, that should be our slogan in response. What is municipal socialism? It's very simple. You see, our social movements have been vibrant. Our social movements have fought hard and have been disparaged, fighting anti-racism, homophobia, you know, for feminism, etc. These have been our broad social movements for broader healthcare, etc. They have been disparaged even by our allies and comrades who've gone into electoral politics. And you know all those parties. They disparage social movements. They want to talk about something called bread and butter issues. They have the fantasy of the white male electorate that they want to go after. They say, let's not talk about racism. Let's not talk about feminism. Let's not talk about sexual liberation. Let's only talk about economic issues. Have you met these people? They are there. They are the people we are often asked to vote for in our localities. The problem with them is they have a fantasy of the voter. They do not realize that the most vibrant parts of our movement are these social movements. The problem is they have taken over the electoral space, and we don't have a theory of how to deal with elections, which is why every 4 years or every 3.5 years, we have the same boring argument, which is, who do you vote for? You can't vote for the Democrats, must vote for the Greens, can't vote for the Greens, have to vote for the Democrats, don't like the Republicans, anyone but Bush, but we have no idea what we'll do when we enter the voting booth. It's the same stupid argument we have every 3.5 years, and it is meaningless. It's a waste of our time. It is a waste of our energy. The real discussion we need to have is, do we as the social movements have a theory of electoral power? Do we know what we're going to do if we take power, how we take power, and are we just going to take power, my friends, so that we can sit inside those town halls and say there is nothing we can do because there is no alternative? That's the question we need to ask ourselves, and I want to ask you this. Have you looked, for instance, at Porto Alegre, where people have been interestingly thinking about things like participatory budgeting? Have you looked at places like Kerala, where people are looking interestingly at things like people's planning? There are many alternatives being planned and practiced around the world, but we live in a bubble in the United States. We believe that even though we are the left, we are exceptional in some way, that we are the leaders in the movement, that we have the ideas and they have the practice, that we should clap when in South Africa they toy in the courthouse, but we, for instance, have the ideas. This is false. We need to look around the world to see how people are in innovative ways taking power in their localities, not just for the sake of power to become the stooges of a capitalist structure, but how to take power, refashion power, create local government where you have, you know, perfectly good resolutions that ban corporate, you know, coming and goings, etc. Why are we always obsessed with the Tobin tax? You know, this is ATAC's thing with France. Why can't we think about Tobin taxes for our localities? We know, for instance, that the hotels are always going to be there. We know, for instance, that many of the manufacturing will not move if we are aggressive in how we deal with them. I would suggest, this is why I really liked, and I'm going to plug the stupid white, How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office, League of Pissed Off Voters. An excellent book, I recommend you read it. There are case studies of innovative people around this country doing innovative things to make broad social movement coalitions one shouldn't be dogmatic, I think, and just talk about this every 3.5 years. We need a theory for our social movements, a theory of how to deal with political power and electoralism. About 10 years ago, almost ending, 10 years ago, the very great dub poet, I don't know if he's listened to anymore, LKJ, the very great dub poet from, well, I guess he's from the United Kingdom, 10 years ago, had a beautiful song. I used to listen to it. It was like a lullaby for me. But then I'm old-fashioned and a romantic, but it's a lullaby for me. The line was, socialism is a wise old shepherd. It's a beautiful song. I should have brought the CD. You could have played it, you know. It may have enlivened things up for me, at least. Socialism is a wise old shepherd. You know, our terrain is a very vast one. We can't afford to have only a short-term vision of social struggle. It is neoliberal economics, neoclassical economics, that lives in the quarter system. They need to post profits every quarter. We don't need to have strategies that are always quarterly. We need to have a very long vision of what we're doing. Socialism is a wise old shepherd. Our road is a long one. We need to travel that road with patience. I hope you will travel it with patience, with fortitude, with strength. And please, let us not be like Hitchens and Horowitz. Let's travel this road for the entirety of our lives. And I'd like to see you there when we're all with our walkers. Thank you.
All right, it's back on. All right, so as you can tell, we asked the speakers to self-facilitate, and we've instilled a lot of fear in them so that we could respect everybody's time. Thank you, Vijay. Anyway, so now we're trying to have this not only be these amazing, fabulous, fabulous thinkers and activists from all over the country, but also, real quick, we're going to have, in between them, we're going to have people who are mobilizing around the RNC and beyond here in New York City share their work with you. So right now, briefly, Judith from United for Peace and Justice is going to talk about their mobilization.
Well, I want to thank the organizers for organizing this weekend because it's a great way to exhale before that final push during the RNC week. August 29th, United for Peace and Justice, we are mobilizing people to go out there in the street to show our country, the world, the people-powered movement that can turn this country around after Bush. Most of you are already working on this, and you know what's going on in the neighborhoods of New York City, and many of you probably are working on it up and down the East Coast and in the Midwest. But I want to tell you a couple of little stories. In Washington Heights, one of the Dominican groups, community groups that are working to mobilize in Washington Heights, took their youth group to see Fahrenheit 9/11 to get them geared up to be on 7th Avenue. In Flushing, New York, a community group, a Colombian association, has spent 3 nights in the last month discussing the links between the war in Iraq, the war in Colombia, and the war in their neighborhood in Flushing. Baptist ministers are discussing at a prayer meeting tomorrow morning how they're going to take their people from the pews into 7th Avenue on Sunday. I want to say that the public workers, the people who check out your books, who repair the highways, who even process your parking tickets, they're being mobilized to be on 7th Avenue on August 29th. Yes, even the cabbies of New York City are mobilizing. The cabbies are calling for every one of their cabs to shine the lights on the lies of the Bush administration 24/7, all during the RNC. And they ask that if you get in a cab and the lights aren't on, to please ask them to turn them on. I just want to end by saying there's only 8 days, and most of you are very involved, but we need you to step up. We need you to step up to write letters to the editor, to call into radio talk shows, to submit op-ed pieces, because right now the drumbeat is on to divide the demonstrators, good demonstrators and bad demonstrators. We're not going to be divided. We have to speak out. This is about the First Amendment. This is about democracy. Yes, the court will hear our case on Tuesday morning, and they will decide whether or not the right, not the privilege, but the right to be in Central Park will be granted. But we want to tell you, United for Peace and Justice believes that no matter what, we want a victory, because we will have hundreds of thousands of people speaking in one voice, and we are building a movement that will stay together long after August 29th to defeat the Bush policies. See you August 29th.
We want to make sure that we're using this space as much as possible to listen to each other and hear what our work is here. And now, Michael Elbert was a co-founder of South End Press and later of Z Magazine, and he co-authored recently Parikon, Life After Capitalism. Please welcome him.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me. The RNC is coming to town. To your town, to nominate a Yale, white male, rich, war-making, agent of imperialism, agent of corporate capitalism to be the next president, not Kerry Bush. That doesn't mean that if I wasn't in a swing state, to emulate my former speaker, I wouldn't vote for Kerry. If I was, I would. And I've never voted for a Democratic candidate for president in my life, and I'm 57. But I would if I was in a swing state. But in a non-swing state, I'll vote for David Cobb. Enough about the election. At a conference called Life After Capitalism, what does discussing life after capitalism have to do with accomplishing anything in the present, which, after all, is what we have to do, accomplish things now? I think the answer is that vision, an understanding of where it is that we want to try and get to, can inform what we're doing, our direction, can give us hope, can give us a reason for our activism. Yet it's many activists, not the ones here, and not the ones who put together these events, but many activists don't have time for vision. They feel it sort of gets in the way of getting on with the business of today. Imagine I was to get up, and I was to give the most powerful, moving, emotional, gut-wrenching speech you'd ever heard. I describe a phenomenon that is so destructive that it limits and it constrains and it narrows our lives, and finally it kills us, one after another of us. And at the end of this talk, and the evidence is just irrefutable, I say, come join me in a social movement against aging. You would think I was crazy. You would think, what are you talking about? But my evidence would be valid. I would have made a compelling and absolutely irrefutable case that this phenomenon rips our lives apart and constrains us and diminishes us over time and eventually kills us. Nonetheless, when I said join a social movement against us, you might say get a life, grow up, face reality, right? Start to pay attention to the way things are. Things that I bet all of you have heard when you talk about poverty or racism or sexism or war or imperialism. And I think the people who say those things to us often have the exact same thing in their head. There is no alternative. There's no point in blowing into the wind. There's no point in forming a movement against gravity. There's no point in forming a movement against poverty and war and racism and so on, because these things are, Tina, they are inevitable. There is no alternative. They are a part of reality. So I admire the effort to get together and to try and talk about, among other things, not exclusively, but among other things, what it is that we want and what is a viable alternative to the system we live under. For me, life after capitalism means that we'd have to come up with a set of institutions to replace the institutions that are central to capitalism. Those institutions are private ownership, profit-seeking, markets, corporate divisions of labor, remunerating people for their power, for their property, even for their output. Those are the institutions that are central to the thing called capitalism. It's not just that capitalism is theft, a very famous expression. Actually, it comes out of the anarchist heritage, I believe. that represents an understanding that there's something about capitalism that causes people's capacities to be ripped off on behalf of a few. It's not just that. Capitalism is also indignity. It's the indignity of blind obedience. It's the indignity of people having to obey orders that are imposed from above. In corporations in the United States, it's often the case that workers have to ask to go to the bathroom. Stalin never dreamed, in his most violent, aggressive moment, of imposing upon a population a regimen in which you would have to ask permission to go to the bathroom. But it's typical in American corporations. It's typical in institutions that are typical of capitalism. So capitalism is that kind of indignity. Capitalism is the subordination of the great many to a tiny few. About 20% of our population have a considerable say in the economic decisions that affect their lives and other people's lives. But about 80% of us simply have to follow orders and fulfill roles in slots that are designed by others for the benefit of others. Capitalism is gargantuan riches and gluttony alongside massive poverty and starvation. At this moment in the United States, there are roughly 7 million empty hotel rooms. There are also roughly 7 million people sleeping under bridges, homeless. At this moment in the United States, there are about 30 million people below the poverty line. Bill Gates' private wealth is roughly comparable to the private wealth of every individual that lives in Norway added together. Capitalism is gargantuan riches alongside inequality and starvation. Capitalism is greedy corporate globalization rather than caring internationalism. It's a process of international organization that tilts the playing field of cultural and political and economic intercourse, international exchange, so that the benefits accrue overwhelmingly to the already wealthy and the already powerful. Corporate globalization is just making that tilt even worse and worse. Our internationalism should tilt it in the opposite direction so that the benefits benefit those who are poorer and weaker more. But capitalism is the former. Capitalism is war and occupation rather than peace. It leads to governments being willing to engage in activities that have the potential, and sometimes do, kill, maim, and exile thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. So capitalism is something we have to get beyond. And for those on the left who are revolutionary, we believe there is something beyond capitalism. But for many people, capitalism and racism and sexism and political authoritarianism are things that seem to them like gravity and are providing a vision of what is better, of what would deliver a better life, is necessary to overcome that kind of cynicism, that kind of lack of faith in the possibility of doing something. So addressing life after capitalism and life after racism and life after sexism and life after authoritarianism seem to me to be critically important questions, critically important endeavors for us to do. For me, I happen to spend a lot of time working on economics because of my background, and the economic vision that sustains a lot of my activity is called participatory economics, and it roughly has four guiding values: solidarity, equity, diversity, and self-management. Solidarity just means an economy should cause us to care about one another instead of be a rat race in which even the winners are rats. It should cause us to care about one another instead of trampling one another. Diversity means that an economy should yield diverse outcomes. It should yield a wide range of choices and options and of experiments and of explorations instead of homogenizing results. Equity means that an economy should reward people for the work, the duration of the work they do, the intensity of the work they do, and the onerousness of the work they do. But not for owning property, not for having a piece of paper in their pocket. That's why Bill Gates is worth more than the population of Norway. Not for output, not for bargaining power. We shouldn't have an economy that's basically the economy of a thug, in which you get more if you can take more. That's actually what we have. To fulfill those core institutions, those core values, I think we need new institutions. I'm going to talk about this a lot on Sunday, so I'm not going to talk about it in any great detail now. I think it means workers' and consumers' councils. I think it means self-managed decision-making. That's the fourth value. We should have a say in the decisions that impact our lives in proportion to the degree that they do so. That's quite different from anything, even from representative democracy, of which we have a facsimile, I suppose you could say, in the United States at best. I think we need remuneration for effort and sacrifice. I think we need balanced job complexes to replace the corporate division of labor. That is, we need a way of working, of dividing up our work that gives us all comparably empowering circumstances, comparably fulfilling conditions in the work that we do. What about gender? I don't know. I think we need a gender vision. 30 years ago, the women's movement was starting to ask questions like, what is it? What is it in social relations which creates a distinction between men and women, which causes a hierarchy between them? Many women thought that maybe it was mothering and fathering. That was an idea that was emerged. The idea that men father and women mother, and that those roles are different, tended in many people's minds to reproduce a sexual division of labor and a sexual hierarchy and a gender hierarchy. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's something else. I think we need to say, we need to explore it, we need to be able to have a vision for gender. We need to be able to have a vision for how cultural communities can interact together respectfully, retaining their autonomy, retaining their dignity, not at war. Maybe it's called multiculturalism, maybe it's called intercommunalism, but we need to be able to express it. In the political realm, there's going to be legislation. There's going to be adjudication of disputes. There's going to be shared program. It is not enough to say, we don't want a state. What we don't want is an oppressive, authoritarian, imposing, coercive state. But there will be political institutions. And so I think we need a political vision for how these political functions are accomplished. The problem that arises is how to win this movement. I really do want to stick to my, or this new world, I want to really stick to my time because I am going to speak a lot over the weekend. I want to just talk about one point. Some years ago I was on a panel, somebody was giving a talk about characteristics of our movement, and a thought sort of flashed through my mind. I asked myself, what would happen if all the people from when I got started, let's say from 1965, a little before when I got started, to now, who became part of the left, or who got into the vicinity of the left, right? People who were in the anti-war movements, the no-nukes movements, the civil rights movements, the women's movements, the gay movement, and so on and so forth, the labor movement. People who took courses from leftists, people who came in the vicinity of the left. If all the people who came in the vicinity of the left, or even a large percentage of them, had, by virtue of the left being, as we're supposed to be, more humane, more caring, more able to create an environment that's fulfilling and rewarding, became more and more attached to the left, more and more committed to the left. If there was a stickiness, if it was like gravity, if people, when they became near the left, got more and more involved in it, cared more and more about it, became more and more committed to it, I asked myself how many leftists there'd be. How many, if this was the case, if this was a characteristic of our movement, that it was sticky, how many of us would there be now? And I thought about it for a while, and I decided there were probably 10 million people, very conservatively, who would come into that position. And if 7 million of them had stuck and were organizing others to stick, we'd have a powerful, at least progressive, probably revolutionary movement in the United States, including 30 or 40 million people. And I almost fell out of my chair. Because the obstacle to this, the reason we don't have this, isn't really, I don't think, that they have a lot of guns. It isn't that they have the media. It isn't any of that. It's that the movements that we build are not conducive enough to people feeling good, to people feeling empowered, for them to stay and feel more and more and more involved. And that, to me, says something about another part of our agenda. I think our agenda should be to address this problem. And I just want to say one last thing about how we do it. One way we do it, I think we know. We learned 30 years ago from the civil rights movement, from the black movement and the Latino movement, that you can't have a movement that's racist and have a movement that is congenial to and empowering to its members, and particularly its members of racially oppressed communities. You can't do it. It's hypocritical. It won't have good politics in those areas. It will not lead those constituencies to say. And then the women's movement taught the same thing. You can't have a movement that is sexist in its internal division of labor. You can't have one that has Jim Crow relations. And you can't have one that looks like the Playboy Club right? Or a professional football team. You can't have one that embodies sexist norms and have it be conducive to people staying. Well, I think there's another law. I think both of those things are true. And I think to a considerable extent, that message has been heard and people try to deal with it. It's hard. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. But much, much progress has been made. I promise you, I was there then and now, and much progress has been made, even though there's more still to make. But there's another axis on which this same issue arises. If we have movements whose internal structure is like that of the institutions we're opposing, is class divided, has people who give orders and who take orders, have people who have corner offices and people who do shit work, has people who get higher income and people who get lower income. If our movement organizations essentially are barely distinguishable in their list of offices and the characteristics of those positions from the ones that we oppose, just like if it's Jim Crow, Jim Crow, sexism, sexism, it will not be conducive to working people. It will not be empowering to working people. And it won't be all that uplifting, and it won't embody something that gives us a belief that there really is an alternative and makes us stick to it. So it seems to me we have to address that too. I think it's true of culture too. The culture of the movement once upon a time was totally macho. It was totally white. And it embodied the worst of that. It embodied the sexism and the racism of that. And there's been an effort to deal with it, but it hasn't been totally successful, but it's progressing. But there's also a sense in which our movement also feels like the Yale Law School, not like a working class pub. It values things that law students value, that people who want to fill those slots in society value, and it disparages things that working people value. Those ills are also a powerful impediment, I think probably a much, much more powerful impediment than the riot club or the gun, to our building a movement that can win. And that's a lucky thing, because it's in our power to do something about these obstacles to growth. And I think when we do something about these obstacles to growth, we will have still larger, still stronger movements that can win a series of changes, that can develop a movement structure, and that can not only make people's lives better in the present, but can lead to fundamentally different institutions, to revolutionarily different institutions in a future that needn't be all that far off. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael Albert. Y'all look beautiful out there. Y'all just give yourselves a... like a Benetton ad. You know, it's kind of funny. You know, oh, it's kind of funny. In the past couple of days, we got some really interesting press around this conference, particularly from that newspaper Record, the New York Post.
Thank you, the New York Post, Yay, New York Post.
And you know, it's funny because they said that... this gathering was going to be a war council, that we're going to have anarchists in the aisles running down with Molotov cocktails and bugging out. But it's funny, you know? It's really funny because you know what? Nobody here has ever been involved. Raise your hand if you've been involved in the bombing of Afghanistan. Nobody here, right? Raise your hand if you've been involved in the bombing of Baghdad. No one here. So this ain't no war council. You know what I'm saying? This is a love council. This is a peace council. This is a justice council. And you know what? If you take the subway, there's a new saying in the subway. They don't really have the voices. They don't really have the voice of the conductor anymore. It's a computerized voice to say, please be aware of any suspicious packaging that may be underneath your chair. If you see something, say something to your local police officer or transit official. Well, you know what? I want to reverse that for a second. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Are you ready for some call and response?
Yeah. No, you aren't. Wait, hold on. Are you ready for some call and response?
That's right. All right. After I say,
well,
oh. Hold on one second. Let me get this right. I want you to say something. If you see racism, what are you going to do?
Say something.
If you see police brutality, what are they going to do? If you see immigrants getting their civil rights violated, what are you going to do?
Say something.
If you see injustice, what are you going to do?
Say something.
Right on, right on.
These are people that are saying something.
And these are some of the beautiful people who are not only saying something, but doing something. Please give it up for Louis from Still We Rise, Poor People's March, and Zochia from A31.
So it's like this huge stage, not exactly a horizontal space, so it takes a while to get up
here. Wow, that was quick. All right. I Still We Rise. We say, I Still We Rise, there's no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. There's no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Say what? All right, you got it. Power to the people. My name is Louis Jones. I'm a person living with HIV for 18 years, co-infected living with hepatitis C. I'm also a drug user advocacy coordinator for Positive Health Project. I'm a member of the New York City AIDS Housing Network, a membership organization led by low-income people living with AIDS in New York, in coalition with housing providers, and together we fight for social justice, more and better housing. The New York City AIDS Housing Network is also one of over 45 community-based organizations and allies that make up the membership of Still We Rise Coalition. Still We Rise Coalition is made up of community-based organizations that address issues around criminal justice system, injustice system, the prison industrial complex, immigration, civil liberties and civil rights, HIV, AIDS, Hep C, hepatitis C, and healthcare, housing and homelessness, income support and welfare, as well as education. We are low-income New Yorkers representing individuals and families and communities that are most impacted and affected by the current administration policies. For over a year, we've been meeting and organizing to march and rally on the Republican National Convention. And guess what? On August 30th, we're marching. We're marching from Union Square to Madison Square, the Garden. And it feels kind of strange to say that we got our permit for the right to march. But we're marching, coming out of the shelters, into the streets. We're marching, coming off the soup lines and off the welfare lines and off the unemployment lines. We're marching, coming out of the sweatshops. We're marching, coming out of the parole offices. We're marching, coming out of business as usual. And we're marching with a message. And our message is that we got a war we can win. And we're saying that we can win the war on AIDS. We can win the war on AIDS to end the AIDS crisis in the communities of color. So this is a war that we can win. And while we're marching and the world is watching, we're going to ensure that they see us, that they hear us, that they feel us, and all we ask is that you join us. And so to respect my comrade coming up next, my five is up. But we'll see you there. Be there at the square. All right.
Thank you, Louis. And now we'll actually have Ronica speaking about A31, a day of creative direct action and civil disobedience.
Yeah. Shorty. Hi. So I just found out about 2 minutes ago that I'm speaking here. So, hi, my name's Ronica Sanyal, and I'm with the August 31st Coalition. And I feel really excited to be here during this historic time, where activists all over the world are coming together to get Bush out of office. Something, yeah. Something like that. And although many of us have serious complaints and concerns about a two-party political system within which the issues of many undocumented people, immigrants, people of color, gender and sexual minorities fall by the wayside, We feel committed to employing the traditions of Martin Luther King, the Black Panther Party, Mahatma Gandhi, and other in-the-street activists right now at this time. They too know what it was to disrupt the culture of business as usual and to be a nuisance. And now they are our national heroes. I think this is a room full of people who will be our national heroes. So who are we? We are thousands of protesters against the war, against corporate welfare, and for a country that provides social services for all of its people. We are mothers, we are artists, we are laborers, and we are a unified, powerful no to our civil liberties being taken away. So please join us August 31st, 6 p.m., at the New York City Public Library, where we'll take the streets and engage in directed, effective civil protest. Thanks.
And see, she just found out, and that's how quick she is on her feet, y'all. So you want to be with her. Right, wait till you see her on that day. So real quick, before we move on, as you all know, or maybe don't, but hopefully by now you do, that Life After Capitalism is a conference that this is kind of the open night event for, is happening this weekend. And we want you to actually just get a glimpse of who in this room has come. Some people have traveled far and wide to come and bring their experiences and their work to us here in New York City so that we can gather together. And this conference has been inspired by the Zapatista model of Encuentro that we're hoping to gather tomorrow and the next day to build relationships and to teach each other and to listen to each other and ask each other questions. So right now, and I don't want people being as shy as they were before, I would like everyone who's going to be presenting or facilitating a workshop or a panel during the next couple days to stand up and wave to everybody. Come on. Hey, you over there, you're standing up. And we hope that we can continue learning from each other during the rest of these couple weeks of beautiful resistance and gathering.
So y'all got that information, right? Don't tell me you ain't got nothing to do or you ain't got no place to go in a couple of weeks, because we gave you plenty of stuff to do. Y'all gonna be busy. The following speaker is an award-winning journalist and author of the international bestseller, No Logo. And you know she's good because she gets The Economist really angry. Give it up for Naomi Klein.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm one of the out-of-towners. I came for the discounts. I might stay for the protests. I love that the solution to any problem in this city is shopping. You know, protest is a privilege, but shopping is an inalienable right in New York City. It's been wonderful listening to all the other speakers. I'm particularly excited about hearing Robin Kelly next. We definitely need his wise words. And I also want to thank the wonderful organizers of this conference. We really do need a space like this to get together and think together before we act. And as the organizers of this conference have already done in many ways, I also want to thank all the hundreds, probably thousands of grassroots organizers in the New York area who have been working tirelessly for months to give the Republicans a welcome that they won't soon forget. I want to thank you for battling landlords to find spaces for us to meet and talk and make media and make protest signs. I want to thank you for facing down police and FBI harassment. I want to thank you for surviving the daily smears in the media. I want to thank you for building the highest tech communication networks and the lowest tech billeting boards. If this convergence is a success, it really is thanks to all of your efforts and hard work. This conference has a very audacious title, as you all know, Life After Capitalism. And in the panels on Saturday and Sunday, I plan to time travel with all of you, I hope, to that place, that far-off place, and imagine what it might look like, and even to tell you about some of the times where I've actually felt that I was catching maybe a glimpse of what life after capitalism might look like. Most notably, I lived for 8 months last year in Argentina after the collapse that we saw in the film The Fourth World War, because I knew that whatever happened after that collapse, whatever was built in the rubble of that collapse, would be a clue for us about what kind of world we could build after capitalism. And something really remarkable happened in Argentina, which was that 200 factories that were facing closure, just as factories in this country have been closing down, the workers were told, you're about to lose your jobs. You know, global capital is mobile. Profits aren't what they used to be. And the workers looked around at the country in flames, and they looked at the fact that unemployment was at about between 40, was it about 40%? And they thought, I don't think so. And they locked themselves inside their factories, and they staged the reverse of a strike, in the sense that a strike is workers withholding their labor. And what they did is they refused to stop working. They said, guys, you can leave, but we're keeping the machines. Or if they were doctors and nurses, they said, we're keeping the x-ray machines, we're keeping the equipment, and we're going to keep it running. So I'm going to be talking about that a little on Sunday. I'm going to be showing clips from a film. But tonight, I have to ask your forgiveness, because tonight I feel the need to talk about death under capitalism and how we might act together at this crucial moment to stop the killing, to stop some of the killing. Because, as Michael said, the road to any better system in the future begins with meaningful acts of solidarity and mutual aid today. So that's why I want to talk about what's going on in Iraq. I want to talk about it because I believe it is our pressing and inescapable moral responsibility to use this moment, when so many of us are going to be coming together, to condemn in the most forceful, clear, possible way the atrocities that are currently unfolding in Iraq. Not just to condemn them. Not just to condemn them, but to make forceful and concrete demands for change. Now, everything is conspiring to make us feel that the protests are all about how we protest, that it's all about tactics. It's become basically postmodern. And there's very, very little discussion about what is actually driving us to the streets, what made us angry. And we need to get back to basics. We need to focus on less on where we protest and how we protest, and more on why we are protesting, what our goals are. What our goals are. Because direct action is about the result. It's not self-expression, it's not theater. It's about having an effect, and we need to get focused on what our goals are. My goal, one of them, let's just choose one, and I know many, all of you share this, is to end the occupation of Iraq. Yes. Now, that goal, unfortunately, has very little to do with the outcome of these elections. Bush and Kerry are both promising, openly bragging, that they are going to stay the course in Iraq. They are promising a long continuation of the brutality that we are seeing. Now, what matters, it's not that there's no hope. It's that we can't count on them in any way. Of course we can. What matters is what Iraqis do there to resist, and what matters is what we do here to support their resistance. Now, I feel like somehow there's fear about talking about supporting the resistance because resistance has somehow become a dirty word in this culture. When we talk about the resistance in Iraq is being equated with terrorism. And I really think we need to stand up to this forcefully. Iraqis are resisting fiercely. They are resisting courageously. They are resisting desperately for their lives and for their country. And so far, I'm sad to say that we on the left, on the in the anti-war movement, whatever you want to call it, progressive movements, we have responded to their courage with deafening silence. Millions of us marched against the war on February 15th, but you know what? I'm sick of hearing that called the other superpower. We don't deserve to be called the other superpower if we are not responding to what is happening in Iraq right now. Where were those voices when U.S. tanks rolled into Najaf, to the holiest city in the Shiite world? Where were those voices? Where were our voices when Iraq was handed over to a brutal CIA spook and then declared sovereign? Where were they when Ba'athist killers and secret police were brought back to restore order? Where were they when U.S. forces declared war on the very forces in Iraq that are calling for direct elections? Now, of course there were rumors. Of course, many people in this room worked to bring people out to the streets. Many people continue to work against the occupation. But we didn't see the unequivocal torrent of solidarity that I know we are capable of, that we saw on February 15th. You know, I have a friend who lives in Mexico City, and she came to New York last summer when the first revelations about the really inescapable evidence about the way the evidence of weapons of mass destruction were being manufactured. She was in New York City, and she said she couldn't believe that New Yorkers and Americans weren't in the streets rebelling, that they had been lied to about why they were sent to war. And she wrote me this email. She said, I keep hearing about how there's resistance in the United States, but I kept waiting for it, and it didn't show up. And I thought, well, if it was there, wouldn't they have used it? And I thought, there was something really strange about the way she phrased it, because I remember thinking the same thing about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Like, if they had them, wouldn't they have used them, right? And I know we tell ourselves we have this power. Like when the right moment comes, we will really be able to mobilize in the moment of truth. But that moment of truth is always deferred. So if we have these weapons, let us use them. Let us use them now. It's time. Because we have an opportunity here in the coming days, in the coming 2 weeks, to do more than reject war, do more than reject Bush, do more than reject the RNC. We can join with the Iraqis fighting for their liberation. We can demand freedom, demand true sovereignty, demand democracy. Now, we are coming together, it just so happens, on the streets of New York, as the occupation is in a brutal new stage. And I want to be very clear about what this new stage is. This war in Iraq, as you know, is the second war on Iraq, or the third if you count the 98 bombings. But within the last war, this is a second war. This is a second war. The first war was waged against Saddam Hussein and the Sunni elite that controlled the country under his power. And the occupation forces believed that the Shia majority would support them. And most of them did support the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, but they did not support the ongoing U.S. military and economic occupation of Iraq, which are, of course, the real reasons behind the war. And I was actually in Iraq, I was in Baghdad, when this second stage, or this second war, opened up in April. And It was very, very clear what was happening. The Shia majority, represented by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, and more recently, as he's been turned into a hero by the U.S. campaign, Muqtada al-Sadr, have been making very clear political demands since December. They have been calling for direct and immediate elections. They have asked for the constitution of Iraq, and this is a crazy idea. You know, Muqtada al-Sadr is always called an outlaw. Here's the crazy idea, that Iraq's constitution should be written after those elections and not before. Not before by U.S.-appointed politicians. That's the crazy idea. And the other crazy idea, the crazy outlaw idea that they have, is that Iraq should control its economy, that it should control, including the oil money, including the reconstruction money. Now, at first they made these demands. When I first came to Iraq, these demands were being made with mass demonstrations. They were being made in newspapers, and we were hearing all kinds of celebrations of the free press. There were 100,000 people on the streets of Baghdad in January chanting, yes, yes, elections, no, no, selections, which is what the U.S. was proposing. They held strikes, they held sit-ins. None of this was really reported on in the press. And a friend of mine who I worked with in Iraq told me that they got a copy of a tape that Voices in the Wilderness made of peaceful, nonviolent resistance through history, and it was footage of sit-ins. It was teaching them all the tactics of Martin Luther King, of Gandhi, and they watched these videos and they made copies of them, hundreds of copies. They watched them in Hilla and Najaf, and they tried it, and they got crushed. Their newspapers were shut down. Their leaders were attacked and sent to Abu Ghraib. Their peaceful demonstrations were fired upon. Then their neighborhoods were attacked with tanks, with missiles. When I was in Baghdad in April, I sat with children in Sadr City who'd been hit with U.S. mortar fire in their living rooms because they were being collectively punished for living in neighborhoods that supported Muqtada al-Sadr. They weren't being attacked for having a militia. They were being attacked for making demands for genuine economic and political sovereignty that were a direct threat to U.S. military bases, U.S. reconstruction contracts, and U.S. plans to privatize Iraq's entire economy. Now, only when their neighborhoods were attacked, only when their demonstrations were attacked, did the Mahdi army fight back with force. This is how the Second War started. Now, I didn't really keep track of time, so how much time do I have? 3 minutes? In the past 2 weeks, as you all know, U.S. forces have laid siege on Najaf, and they surrounded the Imam Ali Mosque and Shrine. The latest news today is that Sadr and his forces have actually pulled out of the shrine, but the fighting is continuing in Najaf. There is no ceasefire. I was also in Najaf in April, and what's striking about it is, you know, this, it's unlike any city I've ever seen before because it is a city of the dead. It is a city devoted to death, to burial. The cemetery goes on forever and ever. There are some estimates that 2 million people are buried there. It's probably much, much more. Every devout Shia dreams of being buried in Najaf, where they believe that they're closest to God. And for the past 2 weeks, U.S. Army boots have been stomping through the cemeteries of Najaf, using tombstones to cut for cover to fire at Mahdi fighters. Now, according to the Washington Post a few days ago, the soldiers are getting pretty spooked by this experience, as you can imagine, because bats are flying out of crypts at them, and graves are opening beneath their combat boots, and they slip. And many of the tombstones have photographs of the dead on them, children, women, mothers, fathers, many of them killed by war and by sanctions. But as the mortars explode all around the cemetery, The photographs shatter from the impact. And there was one quote in the Washington Post from one of the U.S. soldiers, Sergeant Hector Guzman, 28, who lives in Houston. And he said, "Wives, daughters, husbands, you just know you're destroying that tomb. It doesn't feel right sometimes. Sometimes." It's come to this. This is what this war has come to. It has taken the lives of an estimated 37,000 Iraqis, almost 1,000 U.S. soldiers, and now the dead are being desecrated, their graves opened, their memories disrupted. This is the face of the war. And it isn't happening in the past, and it's not an abstract debate about weapons of mass destruction. It happened Wednesday. It happened yesterday. It happened today. It will happen tomorrow. Now, if we are an anti-war movement, we need to fight this war with even more ferocious clarity and determination than we fought the first one. We need to side clearly with the people who are fighting the occupation in Iraq. That doesn't mean saying that we agree with Muqtada al-Sadr's political program. I certainly don't. But there is no question that when he calls for elections, for an end to occupation, for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Najaf, and in fact from the entire country, that we have to bring those demands from Najaf to New York City. That is our job. Now, I've heard it said that we should express our solidarity with the people of Iraq by venting our anger here next week. And I can see the appeal, and as you can see, I'm angry, and I can barely contain it. But I believe that we owe the Iraqi people more than our anger. We owe them more than a temper tantrum. We owe them results. We owe them liberation from occupation, from our governments and corporations. We owe them more than that. We owe them massive reparations for two wars and 13 years of sanctions. We owe them something else. We owe them our courage. In Iraq, this past week, as U.S. forces closed in on the shrine, Iraqis displayed incredible courage. Thousands of unarmed civilians flocked to Najaf to act as human shields, to put themselves, their bodies, between the shrine and the tanks. Oil workers in Basra refused to pump oil in protest against the siege. Al Jazeera, despite being banned, is still risking the lives of its reporters to report from Najaf. Now, members of the U.S.-created Iraqi security force have handed their weapons over to the Mahdi army, not all of them, but some of them, saying that they would not participate in the desecration of the holy site. These are acts of unimaginable courage in a country as treacherous as Iraq. The stakes are absolute. So the least that we could do here is brave a probably fabricated orange alert and go to Central Park with or without a permit. That is not too much. All right. Okay, now I'm pandering. I've also heard it said that the purpose of these demonstrations is to send a message to the world, to send a message to the world that Bush, just as he is not welcome on the streets of Baghdad and Rome, London, that he's not welcome on the streets of New York City. And that is a powerful message to send. That's a powerful message to send. But let us be more ambitious than that, because we want to do more than send messages. Let's remember, this is about direct action, emphasis on the action. We don't want to just send messages. We want to send the troops home. We want to send Halliburton home. These are our goals, not self-expression, not memos. Iraq has to stay at the center of our activism in the coming days. Not in the abstract, but in the corporeal, in the real, in the now. We cannot let all of the forces trying to distract us, to derail us, to turn us inwards succeed. Not the Bush administration, which is terrorizing the city with fear, trying to silence us. Not the Democratic Party, which has cynically and deplorably used the genuine moral outrage in this country over the war to try to elect a man who is promising more war. And not the clapping doesn't count. Not the professional ex-hippies who are telling us to stay home and be good, who talk so much and do so little. None of these people can derail us because we know why we're here. Already the war in Iraq is disappearing from the news. I'm talking about the professional X ones. We want to work with people who are still in the streets, not the armchair ex-hippies. I'm sorry. Radicals, it's not, activism is not a phase. You don't grow out of it. I'm with Vijay. We'll be here our whole lives in our walkers. So, these are the forces that are gathered against us, which means we have to be unpredictable. They want chaos. Let's surprise them with our clarity. Let's surprise them with our unshakable determination. Let's not send a message just about the depths of our rage, but about the seriousness of our desire for change. So, forget anybody but Bush. Our slogan for Bush, for Kerry, must be nothing less than justice, nothing less than freedom, here in Iraq, and around the world. Thank you.
Wow, Naomi, that speech was about a code orange. You know, hello? Hey, I'm still here. You know, one of the great things about this conference this weekend is the ability for us to make connections between war, racism, and also make connections in terms of identity movements. And the following two speakers we're going to bring up are going to be helping us make some of those connections. Please welcome Steve Williams and Hoon Lee from the Still We Rise Fighting Racism and Abroad and at Home Coalition. Thank you.
My name is Hyun Lee. I represent Still We Rise, Racial Justice 9/11. And this is Steve Williams, part of a contingent from the Bay Area called SIAFU. Still We Rise, Racial Justice 9/11 is a coalition of grassroots, people of color organizations. We represent low-wage workers fighting for dignity and respect on the job, low-income tenants fighting to defend their families from displacement as a result of gentrification. Also, people fighting against budget cuts in education, healthcare, and housing as a result of rising military spending. Arabs, Muslims, South Asians defending their communities against detention and deportation. Palestinians fighting to end Israel's violence and occupation of Palestine. And people fighting in solidarity with the people's struggles in Colombia, Korea, and Philippines. Together, we have come together and forged a coalition to take a collective and unwavering stance against this unjust, racist war waged by the imperialist regime of the United States against third world people abroad and third world people here at home.
So
So again, my name's Steve Williams, and I'm a part of a contingent from the Bay Area called SIAFU that'll be bringing about 50 organizers and activists who have united in our opposition to George Bush and U.S. imperialism and are here with you to try to build an anti-imperialist movement within the U.S. empire. Now, I can see by the expression on a lot of your all's faces that you haven't spent enough time watching nature documentaries and don't understand the nature of the word SIAFU. SIAFU is an African ant that is known to be able to take down, despite its own small size, is capable of taking down animals much larger than itself, including elephants, through highly maneuvered tactics and coordination. So you can make whatever connections you'd like to with that. About 49 years ago, the National Liberation Movement in South Africa came together to begin putting together their own vision of what South Africa would look like after capitalism. For about a year and a half, everyday people from South Africa walked around putting in barrels, putting in buckets, ideas, snippets of what it is that they wanted their country to look like after they were able to crush the apartheid regime. That document ultimately was known as the Freedom Charter. Now, almost 50 years later, we've decided, in conjunction with the activists who have called for one fierce no and millions of yeses, the Still We Rise Coalition and SIAFU have come together to try to begin putting together what our vision of the world after capitalism, after imperialism, after white supremacy, after patriarchy, what that'll look like. And for us, that is the Liberation Charter. And so what we wanted to do is just to spend a couple seconds reading from the preamble of the Liberation Charter.
Liberation is the birthright of all people around the globe, from Brooklyn to Baghdad, from Caracas to Compton, from Port-au-Prince to Palestine to Pyongyang. That right cannot justly be denied by any person, government, or imperial power.
However, this right is unjustly stolen in the service of a worldwide imperialist system which is fueled by white supremacy and patriarchy. Today, the United States represents the greatest threat to true liberation of the world itself and to the people of the world.
Therefore, we, the people living inside oppressed communities within the borders of the United States, declare for all the world to know that only a global system based on political and economic justice and solidarity can secure total liberation for all of humanity.
The United States is a white settler nation feeding on a long and bloody history of murdering and enslaving people of the world, especially Arab, African, Asian and Pacific Islander, indigenous and Latino people. And now it is the United States that represents the most savage threat to the natural environment and to the people of the world.
The people of the world have already stood up and taken to the streets in the millions to assert that we should all be free from tyranny, imperialist greed, warmongering, and environmental destruction.
Neither the Republican nor the Democratic parties will offer liberation for the people of the world. Our liberation is in our hands. We must challenge and struggle with the ruling classes within the belly of the beast if we hope to bring about true liberation.
True liberation is contradictory in every way to the existing world order of imperialism, white supremacy, patriarchy, heterosexism, transphobia, ageism, and ableism. Therefore, we must challenge and struggle against all systems of oppression and those who uphold them.
The people of this country must stop identifying with the United States government, an imperialist superpower which exists on patriotism, social conformity, a disposable consumer lifestyle, white supremacy, and patriarchy.
We will no longer sit back and allow lies told, murders committed, cultures squelched, communities and nations ravaged, and the environment destroyed for the sake of imperialist domination. We pledge ourselves to strive together for the true liberation for all of humanity, side by side with the people of the world. Sparing neither strength nor courage, we demand true liberation at home and abroad.
Thank you.
And this charter is adopted by all the organizations of Still We Rise, Racial Justice, 9/11. And they are El Auda, the Palestine Right of Return Coalition, the Audre Lorde Project, a center for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people of color, the Brotherhood Sister Soul, CAV Organizing Asian Communities, Center for Immigrant Families, Critical Resistance, Domestic Workers United, GAPIMNI, Gay Asian Pacific Islanders of New York, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, May 1st Technology Collective, Nodutor for Korean Community Development, New York City Labor Against the War, Quilombo Collective, Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York, Sister to Sister, SLAM, Student Liberation Action Movement, Third World Within Coalition, and lastly, but not least, DRUM, Daisy Up and Movement. DRUM is organizing a mela tomorrow. It is for immigrant justice led by families and youth facing deportation. It's tomorrow from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. in Jackson Heights, Queens, 73rd Street and Broadway. We hope to see all of you there. Thank you.
Thank you for your courage and for the work that you're sharing with us. And I think that that just makes me want to say, to remind all of us in this room and beyond, that when we talk about who is our movement and who is the movement and what the movement used to be like and what it is now, that the struggle for dignity and democracy is as old as the struggle to defend this land against colonialism and is as old as the struggle to end slavery. And these people are the people that are carrying this on and have been for hundreds of years. Thank you. And last but not least, Robin Kelly has been hailed as a leading African-American historian of what this program says, the modern era. And one of his more recent books, Freedom Dreams, draws on black, feminist, and socialist traditions to stake out the terms of hope for future politics. Let's please welcome Robin Kelly.
Thank you. Well, thanks for sticking around. It's about 9:15. I'm going to try to keep it under 9:15 minutes if that's possible. First of all, thank the organizers for pulling this together. This took enormous courage, which is why you got to reach in your pocket and put out some money to support the work that they're doing. They had to take out, what, a $3 million insurance policy or something like that, some ridiculous amount of money because, yeah, so it's just amazing what they're up against. And we live in a country where we're being touted as being a place of free speech, you know, and of course, that's not the case. I hope you like what I have to say today, because it may make you happy, it may make you depressed. I'm here to try to inspire, but what I have to talk about may upset you, so be prepared. I'm not here to talk about free speech. I'm not here to talk about the right to protest and assemble. Rather, what I want to talk about is the limits of protest. You know, limits of protest, and in some ways, the need for politics of liberation. What we just heard in terms of this liberation charter is brilliant, and I think important, and I'm glad it came before what I had to say, because in some ways it lays a foundation that we need to think about where we're going and what we're imagining. And all three speakers made this point, you know, ahead of me, and I just want to reiterate it. Now, if we get 500,000 people in the streets of New York to disrupt the RNC, this is great. This is fantastic. Okay, there's no question about it. Protests will disrupt business as usual. It'll send a message to the world that there are people in this country that don't accept the current fascist policies that we're up against and don't accept Bush, and that there's a struggle to remove him. It will send a message that there are people in this country who reject empire. It may even bring stock prices down, you know? You never know. It may even contribute to Kerry's election. We don't know, you know, but it's going to do something. It's very, very important. And I don't want to at all question the importance of being out here the next couple of weeks and being out here for the rest of our lives if that's what it takes. But protests alone don't produce the kind of society that many of us dream about. It won't create the conditions of our liberation, in part because liberation requires a transformation of the culture, you know, transformation of the way we think, what we do. It requires deep connections to communities and developing new ways of thinking. Liberation cannot be seized or toppled, nor is it driven by anger, frustration, or oppression. Okay? It's a struggle to change ourselves and in the process to build what we might call the beloved community. I know that sounds corny, but the beloved community in some ways is what we're trying to achieve. You see, I mean, I'm a socialist. That's what socialism was about, I thought. You see, and I'm still a socialist. And I think that we can do better than, you know, capitalism is we know how destructive it is, but we have to really try to think about where do we go from here? What does the beloved community look like? In fact, what's interesting about the film we saw at the beginning, it kind of set the stage for our discussion and for the protest. And the thing I wish I had seen in the film was the part where the Zapatistas talk about how to create community, you know, how to rearrange the land and how to speak to one another. Because in some ways, that's the most dangerous revolutionary thing we could do, you know? I mean, battling the police is dangerous, but remaking ourselves. Okay, so for many of us on the left, protest has become a way to connect. It becomes a culture, a way of life. You know, in some ways, it's very, very important, but we have to think about other ways to build solidarity. Protests are generally acts of self-defense. They are ephemeral coalitions or united fronts where people come together to stop some destructive acts or policies. Social movements, on the other hand, are affirmative, collective struggles to build a new society, hopefully. And we can look at struggles of freed people to build democracy in the South during Reconstruction. We could look at the Civil Rights Movement, the Poor People's Campaign. We could look at the feminist movement, perhaps social unionism. There's all kinds of examples. And all these movements have tried with varying success to change the culture. They've created institutions anchored in communities and challenged power at the level of ideology. Most of these movements generated visions of a different society, visions that were produced by collectives and shaped by struggle. And it should be remembered that some of the most radical social movements worked under conditions of duress that are worse than what we face today. Now, I know things are bad. There's no question about it. But the 1880s were bad, especially for black people, you know? It was a jacked up time, you know? You could walk down the street and get lynched. So I'm with Vijay. I mean, social movements have made a difference, a huge difference. We can't forget that. Things are terrible now. But despite that, despite those conditions, movements have emerged, erupted, succeeded in some ways of maintaining humanity of people inside those movements. A big part of the problem that we face today is that, you know, the left in some ways is disconnected, not the entire left, but much of the left, you know, is kind of disconnected from, you know, working class communities, the poor, and there's a kind of segregation that still exists. You know, there's people of color movements that are doing all this work, and then there are people who sort of talk who are kind of disconnected from people of color movements, who might be working with labor and that sort of thing. So there's connections, but there's a lot of disconnection. And that disconnection is evident, I think, in the way that the so-called left responded to the 2000 election. I mean, when Bush was elected without the majority of the votes, one of the first things that happened, I remember, in terms of the discussions that were taking place, particularly among a lot of white leftists, was that, you know, Nader's a spoiler. Ralph Nader was the person. There was very little discussion at first about the disenfranchisement of black voters, which was the real key thing. Now, of course, now we talk about it thanks to work by people like Greg Palast and others. I mean, now it's really hot on the agenda, and very few people are talking about that. They talk about Florida, and it's so evident now with the intimidation of elderly voters. I mean, if you saw Bob Herbert's column today in the New York Times, that stuff is going on. Now, of course, had we been paying attention, we'd know that this is not new. And I'm not talking about going back to the 1880s. We go back to the 1990s under Clinton, when Attorney General Janet Reno was in office. In the mid-90s, there was all kinds of intimidation against voters and black voters in Alabama. The FBI was investigating voter fraud and actually trying to prosecute, the Justice Department trying to prosecute black voters and black elected officials, when there were all these cases of white voter fraud like the election of Selma's mayor, Joe Smitherman, for example, which went untouched. And it's interesting, this happened in the mid-90s at the same moment when churches were being burned. So the FBI was showing up to people's houses saying, and they're thinking they're coming to see about the burned churches, but instead they're investigating, you know, black voter fraud, you know, and it was all bogus in the end. So, I mean, this is the sort of situation we're in. We've got to pay attention to race. Race and racism is still here with us. Of course, we've been here before. After Reconstruction, which ended in a similarly fraudulent election of a president who did not win the majority of the votes, black people suddenly found themselves disenfranchised, subject to a wave of terrorism, both legal and extra-legal. They had their land seized. They reduced the debt peonage. And what did they do? What did those people do? They built and sustained powerful democratic institutions in their own communities throughout the South and the urban North. They tried to create a community culture based on mutuality, based on respect and sharing. And in this case, they were driven by a prophetic vision of Christianity, but at heart was an ethos that said, we're in this together, we will help each other survive. And they continued to fight back too, and that's another story. But the most important thing I want to emphasize here is that they tried to create the future in the present. They tried to create the future in the present. And this is a point that, you know, C.L.R. James coined that term, and this is what I want to talk about. What I want to advocate tonight is that in addition to, not in place of, but in addition to the kind of protests that we're all going to be engaged in, we should follow the lead of several incredible grassroots organizations and begin to build the future in the present. We need to connect with local communities and help build institutions that allow us to remake ourselves, that create spaces that allow us to dream of a different future and enact those dreams. And there's so many organizations, some are here, that are doing this kind of work. I mean, you mentioned CAB and DRUM and Domestic Workers United. There's the Bog Center in Detroit, which I was going to talk about, but time is short, I won't. What I want to do is limit myself to one organization, which is, to me, one of the most amazing, important organizations that we need to pay attention to. They're represented here. That's Sister to Sister. They're based in Bushwick neighborhood in Brooklyn. Yeah. Definitely. And in their own words, they are, quote, a collective of working-class young and adult black and Latina women building together to model a society based on liberation and love. Our organization is dedicated to working with young women to develop personal, spiritual, and collective power. We are committed to fighting for justice and creating alternatives to the systems we live in by making social, cultural, and political change. Now, like the Bog Center in Detroit, they have a longstanding freedom school for young women of color. They've already had almost 500 graduates who have gone on to work in other progressive organizations, become school teachers, and continue to work in the collective. And I recently spoke with one of the amazing organizers, Paula Rojas, who's my hero, who told me about some of the work that they're doing, which I'd like to share with you, and examples of the politics of liberation that I'm trying to advocate here, and that is creating the future in the present. One of the issues that the women face, well, women face all over the globe, but in this case in Bushwick, is violence, both domestic and interpersonal violence and state violence in the form of police harassment. So Sister to Sister had been waging a campaign against police violence, like many organizations, but then the collective recognized the fundamental contradiction. That's this. Victims of domestic violence generally rely on police to intervene. Police officers are among the highest perpetrators of domestic violence themselves, not to mention the threat to the community, so why turn to them? That was the question. That was a fundamental contradiction. So what do? They ask themselves, in our vision of how we want the world to be, how would we deal with interpersonal violence without the police? So they looked at other models around the world, especially in Latin America, and came up with the concept of sisters liberated ground, creating spaces where violence against women is not tolerated. These spaces included designated buildings, schools, parks, and to protect these spaces, a circle of women who were trained in self-defense and conflict resolution. They would deal with violence not as individuals, not as households, but as a community issue. And they would confront abusers together. The purpose, of course, is to change the culture, to create a society where no one in the neighborhood tolerates violence against women, and the entire community looks after each other to protect and educate each other. They do street theater that enacts some form of abusive behavior and then shows how interventions can take place. They hold video screenings and discussions in the community about domestic violence. And what they have been doing is slowly, you know, working. I mean, it's really changing the culture. There were men initially hostile to Sister to Sister who have begun to come around, and more people are approaching the collective about making their own buildings Sisters Liberated Ground. Now, to me, this is amazing revolutionary work. Amazing. It's very, very important. It's dangerous work. It's dangerous work. And yet, once they extended their focus beyond traditional protests against police brutality to creating a safe space and community culture that no longer tolerates domestic violence, their funding started to disappear. Now, isn't that deep? And funding from where? From progressive left funders. You see? Why? Because they can't conceive of this as actual work, as actual real organizing work. And yet, this is precisely what liberation is about, radically transforming ourselves and our culture. And it is driven by an ethic of love for community. And as Paula Rojas told me recently, the work feels different when you're doing it out of sister solidarity, not just a hatred of the police. Now, the central point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, we organize to build something. We struggle because of love and communities we care about, not just opposition to our oppressors. That's not a way to build a movement because it does sustain itself. That's why when Steve Williams and we had, you know, Red and the other sister whose name I apologize, read the Liberation Charter, you know, in some ways, this is about trying to create humanity, a humane life. You know, it's not just about resistance against oppression. It's about what you build. And to me, in some ways, this is what we should be doing. There's so many other organizations that are doing this, creating collectives for economic self-sufficiency and childcare, providing political education for working mothers, building models based on what's coming up, what's developed in Cuba and Nicaragua and Brazil. And the activists and sister, you know, of course, turn to Latin America and other third world liberation movements for inspiration and ideas. And the fact that they do this kind of brings me to my final point, which is that true liberation requires a commitment to anti-imperialism, and solidarity with the oppressed worldwide. And, you know, Naomi's talk, this is exactly her point. It's not enough to be in a peace movement and say end to war. You've got to actually be in solidarity with the people who they're waging war with. You know, it happened in Vietnam. You know, you can't just say you're sort of against the war in Vietnam. You've got to be for the people in Vietnam. You've got to be for the people in Iraq. And what that requires is that we, as a people, need to liberate ourselves from American nationalism and embrace humanity. There's no such thing as a left patriotic position. And it just kills me that these like so-called leftists who like wrap themselves around the flag. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. Now, put simply, the victims of imperialism are our allies, pure and simple. We cannot afford to embrace blind patriotism that defines loyalty in terms of support for the ruling interests of the nation state. Wherever the U.S. empire raises its ugly head, abroad or right here in the ghettos of North America, working people and their allies across national borders need to be prepared to do battle. We need to follow the example of the French and Caribbean surrealists, who in 1932 published a broadside called Murderous Humanitarianism, in which they vowed to change the, quote, imperialist war in its chronic and colonial form into a civil war. As activists and working people living here in the U.S., we have to bear much of the responsibility for waging a sustained attack on imperialism. We need to continue to organize teach-ins, provide material, moral, and tactical support for victims of U.S. wars of aggression, battle both Republican and Democrats over foreign and domestic policies, support international justice efforts such as the Third World Tribunal on Iraq. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that the American empire threatens the future of humanity. And I'm obviously not the first one or the last one to say it. In fact, nearly half a century ago, W.E.B. Du Bois warned us of the consequences of the new American empire. His words are startlingly prescient. He says, quote, "Today, we are lying, stealing, and killing. We call all this by finer names, advertising, free enterprise, and national defense. But names, in the end, deceive no one. Today, we use science to help us deceive our fellows. We take wealth that we never earned, and we are devoting all of our energies to kill, maim, and drive insane men, women, and children who dare refuse to do what we want done. No nation threatens us. We threaten the world." Now, And I wish I said that. Du Bois said that, you know. He's the man. Just to conclude, in the end, we're about to embark on something that's bigger than Bush, bigger than Kerry, bigger than Democrats and Republicans, bigger than Homeland Security, and bigger than the CIA. We must fight these battles as they come. We must also begin to build the future in the present. And for this, this is the key to revolution, okay, to revolution. And I said the word revolution because I think that we need revolution. Revolution is a word we can't be afraid of. We need revolution. The survival of much of the world depends on it. But what is revolution? Revolution is not burning down buildings or the violent seizure of the state or filling Central Park with anti-Bush supporters. That may be road towards it, but that's not revolution. It means developing a vision of a new world and working to build it, and wherever it's possible to live it, to create our communities as liberated zones and try to figure out how to become what we want to be. It means putting some of the old books aside and drawing on the wells of our collective imagination, an imagination fired by active participation in the very social movements that we'll be a part of in the next week, the very protests we'll be involved in the next couple weeks. It means, you know, engaging with real people, not on the internet and not just in demonstrations. It means self-transformation and community participation, but it also means seeing the whole world and taking seriously a commitment to internationalism, you see. It means learning to respect the knowledge and experience and strength of so-called ordinary people. It means working together to purge ourselves and our communities of the racism and sexism and homophobia that still persists, even among the left. And perhaps most importantly, we don't have to wait until November 2nd to do this, you see? We can begin right now. And for those of us committed to liberation, we really need to, you know, wake up and start to dream. Thank you very much.
All right, so real quick, people mentioned this before, but we've been put through hell to try to organize just this little meeting of people talking to each other. And I'm really going to ask everybody who can to please stay. We only have a few more minutes. So y'all, like, turning around and walking out, I'm talking to you. So what Hunter College, for blatantly political reasons, perhaps it had to do with the fact that we're talking about life after capitalism, has charged us, put us through hell to make this event happen, and charged us at the last minute, told us that we had to get a $3 million aggregate insurance for this space, charged us thousands of dollars, and treated us like shit. All right?
You know?
So we know that this is part of a broader problem in New York. We need radical spaces of our own because they don't give them to us.
And you know what? It's a funny thing, too, because Hunter College, this particular college, was the place of Ruby Dee, of Sonia Sanchez, of Audre Lorde, of Bella Abzug, of That's the Student right. Liberation Action Movement. This That's is a right. place, it's a public place, and it needs to remain public for the use of the people whenever you want, wherever you want. Hey, y'all, we got to make it happen.
So, but for now, because Hunter College Central Reservations has extorted thousands of dollars from us, we have these lovely people walking around right now collecting money so that we, for now, can support each other's work. Because we, as we said, they totally extorted money from us, and we need your help to try to make some of that money back so we can continue supporting the activists and activism that is part of life after capitalism. So people are coming up and down the aisles right now.
We can do this like church, y'all.
Which I don't know anything about. So if people know something about raising money at church, do it, all right? And
Give
if you
up,
don't,
y'all.
We're trying to be multicultural, you know? All right, so, and there's a couple more shout-outs that we wanted to do. Kazimbe, did you want to shout out some people?
Oh, yeah, man. I want to shout out all the anarchists in the house, including the anarchist people of color. I also wanted to shout out the Student Liberation Action Movement, SLAM.
They're the part of Hunter that we love.
And we want to shout out to the Arts and Action Collective that helped transform this space, as you see here. And now we're going to end with another reading from the Zapatistas, because that's where a lot of this began. It's a part of the message that was given at the opening remarks at the first Intercontinental Encuentro for Humanity and Against Neoliberalism. So we thought on the eve of the Republican National Convention that this would be appropriate. We are the same simple and ordinary men and women who are repeated in all races, painted in all colors, speak in all languages, and live in all places, the same forgotten men and women. The same excluded, the same untolerated, the same persecuted, we are you.
I got it. Behind us, you are us. Behind our masks is the face of all excluded women, of all the forgotten indigenous, of all the persecuted queers, of all the despised youth, of all the beaten migrants, of all those imprisoned for their words and thoughts, of all the humiliated workers, of all those dead from neglect, of all the simple and ordinary men and women who don't count, who aren't seen, who are nameless, who have no tomorrow.
Brothers and sisters, we have invited you to this meeting to seek for and find yourselves and us. You have all touched our hearts, and you can see we are not special. You can see we are simple and ordinary men and women. You can see that we are the rebellious mirror that wants to be a pane of glass and break. You can see we are who we are, so we can stop being who we are to become the you who we are. We are all Zapatistas. Thank you and good night.
The conference starts tomorrow, 11 o'clock, at the CUNA Graduate Center. The ground beneath my feet.